Marriage formation and strong families are essential to a healthy and flourishing society. This truth was once widely accepted, but today it's controversial in some circles. Now, one thing is clear, marriage and family formation is in decline in the United States. There's been over a 60% decline in the marriage rate, I should say, since 1970. The fertility rate in the United States reached a new low of 1.599 births per woman in 2024. That's according to provisional CDC data. And the replacement rate, by the way, is 2.1% to sustain the population. And younger generations today fear commitment and don't desire to have children. Now, what has led to the demise of marriage, fidelity, and family? Is there a political solution? And what's the role of the church? I'm Richard Nelson, host of The Commonwealth Matters, and joining us to talk further is Ryan T. Anderson, the president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, a premier Washington, D.C. public policy organization that applies the riches of the Jewish and Christian traditions to contemporary questions of law, culture, and politics in pursuit of America's continued civic and cultural renewal. Ryan has been a leading thinker and influential leader in areas of marriage, family, and the sanctity of human life. He's authored or co-authored 5 books, and his research has been cited by 2 U.S. Supreme Court justices. And earlier this year, he was appointed by President Donald Trump to the newly created Religious Liberty Commission. Ryan, welcome to the Commonwealth Matters.
Thanks for having me. It's a real pleasure to be with you, and I'm looking forward to coming to Louisville, and I guess it's just now 2 weeks away.
Yeah, less than 2 weeks away. You are joining us for a conference on the family and cultural renewal. You're going to join Dr. Al Mohler, Denny Burke, Colin Smothers will be there as well, and we're going to talk about the importance of marriage, the importance of family to a healthy and flourishing society, and your specific area is you're going to cast a vision for strong marriages and healthy families. But I guess in order to get to that part of a vision that implies that something is wrong with the family today, as I just teed this program up with, but we're going to slog through some of the challenges that have faced the family in the last several decades in this country. And I think, Ryan, a good place to start would be with a recent column that you wrote called Victims of the Revolution, that was found on your Ethics and Public Policy Center website. In that article, you call the sexual revolution a disaster. You point to the deaths of unborn children who've never gotten to see the light of day, kids in fatherless homes, women who've been objectified and used by men, men addicted to pornography and who are unable or at least unwilling to commit, gender dysphoric children. The list goes on, but those are the high points. You say this in your column, that the sexual revolution is built on a series of lies about the human person, and there are human costs to getting human nature wrong. Now, Ryan, here's where I want to go with this. There's a lot there. The culture today is reinforcing these lies, whether it's popular culture and music and movies and our entertainment, ideology in our schools that's being promoted in the classroom. The medical establishment has been corrupted. These lies have been put forth and they're reinforced. And I guess, so where do we even begin with that? We've got a mess rejecting God's, the idea of marriage. It's been redefined by the court. The idea of male and female, it's become law in some areas. There are some states that are considered sanctuary states for gender dysphoric youth. It's a mess. So where do we begin, in particular in combating the lies? We'll narrow it down to that. How do we begin when the cultural tide is pushing so strong against God's revealed order of marriage and male and female, the givenness of human nature? Where do we begin? That's a lot there. We could spend a lot of time just on that.
I mean, let me start by saying, I think we begin exactly where you're beginning. The conference that you're organizing in Louisville, and I said 2 weeks, you're right, it's only a week and a half away now.
Make sure you get that right on your calendar. We need you there.
The plane is booked.
Good.
The airfare, that actually reminds me, I need to check. I don't know if I booked a hotel yet, but we can chat about that offline. Yeah. But the title of the conference and the purpose of this is the family as the key to cultural renewal. And I think that is the place to start, is to recognize that anything that you care about, if you care about social justice, if you care about human flourishing, if you care about limited government, if you care about the poor, if you care about the elderly, if you care about children, all of those causes is best served by a strong, healthy marriage culture. It's not as if you could say, oh, well, I care about these things plus the family, or like the family is a nice afterthought or a nice like additional thing if we get around to it. None of those other things will be successful. Your attempts at limiting government, or your attempts at combating poverty, or your attempts at employment or crime or drugs, if you don't get the family right. And so I think one place to start is just by acknowledging.
Yeah.
Second thought I have is that social conservatives have not waged a systematic, coordinated, sophisticated response to the sexual revolution in the way that other types of conservatives waged responses to their kind of threats. And so you could think about how, you know, there was a certain type of fiscal conservative who responded to the New Deal and the Great Society. Judicial conservatives, the launch of the Federalist Society, responding to living constitutionalism and judicial activism. And I think that's the right example to focus on. Think about what someone like Leonard Leo did and the other founders of FedSoc. Obviously, it wasn't just Leonard, but they said, we have a huge problem with the Supreme Court. We have a huge problem with runaway jurisprudence, utterly detached from the Constitution, and we're going to play a long game. It might take us 30 or 40 years, but we're going to reform the judiciary, and they do it. And we now have, you know, 5.5, maybe 6, depending on how you count, conservative justices on the Supreme Court. And the two big kind of desideratum, overturning Chevron deference and overturning Roe, you know, both come to fruition within the past 2 terms at the Supreme Court. Okay, so then you've probably been in the social conservative battle longer than I have, but I think just about my own time, like, we've had one-off skirmishes. We did what we could on same-sex marriage, you know, and ultimately we lost, not because of ballots. Like, we were winning all of the state ballots on marriage. We lost because of judicial activism, right? The personnel turnover in the Supreme Court came just a few years too late, right? That was a 5-4 ruling against us. And you could see how, had FedSoc been successful slightly earlier, Obergefell and Windsor might not have gone the way that they did. But, you know, we had one-off skirmishes on things like redefinition of marriage, things like transgender ideology, right? And we've been much more successful on trans than we were on marriage. But we've never, to my knowledge, brought like the coordinated, sophisticated, long-term strategy that something like the Federal Society brought to judicial activism. And so I think one place to start is just to acknowledge that, you know, we might want to play a long game and think through what would a coordinated strategy that's multifaceted look like. My thought, you know, there immediately goes to say, all right, well, if you look at marriage in America, you know, where is it most flourishing? And it's amongst people who are serious religious believers. And so, you know, there's a strong correlation in American marriage statistics between social class, you know, education, employment, things like this, religious practice, and then marital outcomes. In terms of who gets married and who stays married. And so that would be one place to think through, you know, anything we can do that would protect religious liberty. You mentioned President Trump has appointed me to the newly established Religious Liberty Commission. Anything we can do to kind of foster ed reform, school choice, right? These are all going to pay dividends down the road, right? Not within the next 5-10 years. But if you think about, you know, the children being born and educated today, anything we can do to shape their formation is going to be 20 years from now reflected in some of the marriage statistics.
Hi, Richard Nelson here with the Commonwealth Policy Center. Have you found yourself frustrated and angry about the direction of the country? Maybe you're watching Fox News and you see what's happening in Congress or in other parts of the country. Let me encourage you to turn your frustration and energy into a positive direction. Have you considered running for local office? And listen to me for a minute. You can have a greater impact on local elections and on policy decisions if you serve in local government. School board, for example, they set curriculum decisions and tax policy. How about city council or fiscal court? These are very important elected offices where you can have a positive impact on. Consider running for local office. CPC is bringing candidate training events all across the state, and we'd love for you to join. If you've ever felt called to run or interested in running, come on and join us. You can find out more information at the Commonwealth Policy website at commonwealthpolicycenter.org. Go ahead and check it out, and we hope to see you in the fall. This is something I've been involved with 30 years. Here at Commonwealth Policy Center for 13 years, I've worked for other state-level pro-family organizations, and it seemed for years that we were just putting our fingers, if you will, in the proverbial dike. Yep. Whenever there's a leak that would spring out, yeah, and it's and we maybe have stemmed the flood for a season, but mm-hmm. Ryan, the culture pushes so strong. That cultural current is pushing so strong. What are maybe just a couple of things that you would see as long-term strategies for the social conservative movement? Maybe a thing or two that we could be working on now that will have the impact 5, 10, 20 years down the line.
Yeah. Let me give one example. It's something I would like to do, but I have not yet been able to find the donors to help me do it. And I imagine you're familiar with this phenomenon as well. But here's a thought I have. We have very little empirical knowledge of what works in terms of forming the next generation to be marriage-minded. And what I mean by that is we have a whole network now of faith-based schools. You know, we have parochial schools, we have classical academies, we have Christian classical academies, we have Catholic classical Catholic academies. Right? We have all sorts of alternatives to the government-run public schools. It would be worth conducting an audit, a study that would say, let's look at what the marriage rates are for these schools. All right, so you're sending your kids to, I know there's a really good classical academy in Louisville, right? And you say, all right, 5, 10, 15, 20 years after graduation, what do the family structures look like for the grads? And then you could say, all right, well, this school has a really, really high marriage rate and a really, really low divorce rate. And, you know, the graduates go, but this school doesn't. All right, let's compare, right? And figure out what are the schools that have the best kind of long-term marriage rates for their alums. What are they doing K through 12? What does the high school culture look like? What does prom look like? What does, no one likes using the term courtship because it sounds so dated. But what does a courtship culture look like at these schools? How are you not just like educating the brain, but also like kind of forming the chest? If you think about C.S. Lewis's, you know, Men Without Chests, to my mind, that would be a really valuable study because then you can replicate best practices. And if you're thrown into a situation where you're the principal of a classical Christian school, you can say, all right, well, here are the best practices. I know because I've looked at the research. This is what other schools have done. It pays dividends. These are the things we can do in our campus community that 5, 10, 20 years from now are going to produce graduates who are happily married. I'm always amazed when I get every 6 months or so, my alma mater from, you know, college, from high school will send out the little like magazine that then has like the back of the book where they give you all of the class notes, the updates on what the graduates are doing.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And I'm always just like, fascinated to see, well, what do they report in there? And, you know, they'll report, here are the colleges that our graduates got accepted into. You know, here are people getting, you know, jobs. Every now and again, marriages, births, yeah. Things like this. But there's much more of a focus on professional success in those kind of alumni magazines than there is on familial success. And so, again, like one thought would just be, if this is what we really care about, start measuring it. Start quantifying, figuring out some rules of thumb, some best practices. I think another area that, you know, we've been much quicker to respond. We were behind on this, but I think we've accelerated. We got caught up is what to do about these things on campuses, what to do about these things. And for people who are only listening, not watching the video, I'll mention, I held up my iPhone, but you know, what do we do for this next generation of, you know, young people with digital technology, social media, smartphones, because I think that has a huge underappreciated role when it comes to things like dating and marriage, family formation, children. And so, you know, again, like some of the schools that I'm most impressed with right now are not only saying no cell phone in the classroom or no cell phone on campus, they're saying until a certain age, no cell phone at all, no social media account at all. And we're going to covenant together, all of the families at this school, we're going to say all of us are agreeing to not give our kids social media accounts or smart devices until age, you know, 16 or 18, something like that. And that way, no individual child experiences it as like a personal burden. Yeah. You know, why are my parents so oppressive? I don't have a phone. Everyone else does. But then also that means no child is left out. Yeah. So many schools, unfortunately, you know, like the sports teams, soccer coaches communicate to their teams through group chats or through apps or through social media, right? Facebook events are how you find out about social life or athletic life or extracurricular life. Well, again, like if your child is the only one that doesn't have Facebook, it doesn't have a smartphone, they're missing out on that. But if everyone agrees, we're not doing this, right?
Right.
You can see the dividends.
Ryan, and to add to that, we do know that smartphone use and excessive use or any use on social media has negative effects on our young people, especially young teenage girls, where it's hard enough to be a teenager, but a teenage girl that is trying to fit in and they're comparing themselves to other girls. It's just been a disaster for them in a lot of ways. Here in Kentucky, by the way, a bill passed last legislative session that banned cell phones in the classroom in K through 12 schools, which is good. There's been efforts to restrict social media use. And I think the legislature here was waiting to see what happens with their court cases in other states that they're trying to figure out the constitutionality of that. But those are two really good areas to start.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, actually, another guest you could consider having, my colleague at the Ethics and Public Policy Center, Claire Morell, has written a really excellent book on this. It's called The Tech Exit. And it's more or less like a user guide for parents on how to help, if their kids are already, you know, heavily invested into like digital technology, how to help them exit from that. But more importantly, like the back half of the book is really like, well, look, you can't just say no to the social media and the smartphone. You need to say yes to some alternative vision of childhood. And that's I think right. That's what I find particularly helpful in Claire's book is here's how to give your kids the type of childhood that you and I most likely had. Because I think we both came of age prior to Al Gore inventing the internet. And that's a very different childhood than what a lot of kids are experiencing right now. And so Claire gives some really, really helpful, practical, actionable advice in her book.
So Ryan, our young people today have a fear of marriage. Pew Research did a survey recently. They found that one out of every four 40-year-old American adults have never been married. There's a fear of parenthood. One Pew study found that less than half, 45% of young women aged 18 to 34 without children say that they still want to have kids at some point. That means that 55% of them don't want to have kids. So there's a reluctance to get married. There's a fear of parenthood. Where do we begin with that? I think you touched on it a little bit. You'd like to do a survey of what is being taught in the classroom, public school compared to the private school setting. But these are huge obstacles. When there's a fear, when you have a couple of generations that are afraid of marriage. And of course, I'm going to go back to the culture sending negative messages. The popular TV programs and even a lot of the music undermines marriage. And they encourage, on the other hand, hookups and just find, you know, be with somebody for a while and then move on to the next person. That's the milieu that our young people are growing up in. The negativity towards marriage formation. Many of them today they're in single parent homes. I think it's about a quarter of all young people today are in a home led by a single parent. And then you put on top of that the fear of parenthood. So we have these really important elements of healthy cultural formation that are being undermined in all these ways. Any further thoughts on what we do with this? Are you still working on this part of your talk for our conference?
Yeah, well, no. I mean, so there's a lot to say there. And let me underscore what you said about like popular culture. I think almost every TV show that was kind of like a smash hit, high ratings, you know, the must watch, everyone's talking about it from my youth, glamorized a high school, college, young adulthood of casual sex without marriage. I think of TV shows like Beverly Hills 90210, Melrose Place, Married with Children, Friends, Seinfeld, right? I'm obviously dating myself, but the point here is that I think a lot of people at the time, and you can even think of like some Tipper Gore style concerns, was about like, or for that matter, Dan Quayle type concerns. Some concerns were just about like sexual explicit images or lyrics or those sorts of messages. Like, oh, we don't want nudity on TV or we don't want obscene speech. But what was lost was like, well, what's the plot line? What is the storyline? Even if, let's say on your like 8 o'clock primetime TV show, the scene ends with, you know, the male and female going into a bedroom, you go to a commercial break, and then the next scene starts with them in pajamas in the kitchen, right? And so there, there was no visualization of the sex act. Yeah. But the storyline surrounded around, here are young professionals, not married to each other. And what it glamorized was, I want to be an unattached 20-something leading a professional life with no kids, going to bars, restaurants, you know, casual, non-committed sex, et cetera, et cetera. And so it set a kind of a cultural script of, this is what the good life looks like, right? What I want to do is have freedom, independence. And in that vision, marriage and kids, and think about the TV show, Married with Children, Al Bundy, almost every father from this generation of TV show, the fathers are always these like doofus, Homer Simpson, Al Bundy style characters. Yeah. Children and family life look like drags, right? Yeah. This would be the end of my happiness, the end of my freedom, the end. So one thought here is that there are now several new Hollywood studios, things like Sycamore Studios or Angel Studios, that are like alternatives to like the big mainstream productions. Here's somewhere where technology actually helps us. The fact now that most people don't just have three choices, ABC, CBS, and NBC, right? There are now dozens of streaming apps. You know, my wife and I, when we choose, you know, if and what our children will be watching, it's almost always a show that was created in the 70s or the 80s simply because we don't trust anything that came after. But now there are new programs being created. I want to say one of the studios says content so good that you can leave the room, with the idea being that you could leave the room and your kids watching it, you don't have to worry, but it's so good that you don't want to leave the room, that it's artistically high quality that you want to watch it. You know, one problem I would say for most of like the after school specials of my childhood is that they were so hokey and so kind of like low production value and like so explicitly moralistic that you didn't want to watch them, right? They're trying to do something that has a good message that'll reinforce the values my wife and I are trying to instill in our kids, but without being a hokey after school special. So that's one thought. The other thought, I think my generation of parents is much more intentional with the formation of our children than my parents' generation was with us. I think this is partly what Rod Dreher is getting at in, you know, his Benedict Option book. And there are lots of debates about what it does and doesn't mean. And, you know, people have characterized it as like heading to the hills and disengage. I think at its best, what Rod was getting at was, we can no longer assume that the ambient culture is supportive of Christian values and the transmission of Christian values to our children. And we need to be really intentional as a church, intentional as a family. And what I'm seeing is that the areas of the church, both Catholic and Protestant, where there's vitality, everyone gets this. And the local church gets it, the school gets it. And so now the question was like, all right, so we know we need to be intentional. We now need to come up with like, you know, what are the best practices? And that's what I'm getting at with, it would be worth looking at what various schools are doing and which ones really move the needle. What sort of campus culture policies move that needle? But anyway, so that'd be two places I would start, is like thinking about alternatives in pop culture production and the messages that those things send. And then second, our own educational institutions, especially now that we're having more and more school choice. You know, the One Beautiful Bill contained for the first time ever a federal school choice tax credit. And it's circuitous that, you know, it creates scholarship granting organizations that then you can donate to and then they can create. But it's the nose of the camel is now under the tent, right? And, and this will grow over time. Universal school choice, I think, will be a reality within the next decade, would be my guess. Maybe optimistically hopeful, but like that will revolutionize things, because no longer will our kids be trapped in the government run schools and indoctrinated there.
Yeah, very good. Ryan, we are running out of time, but I do want to close with this and then ask a question about the church. But you say in your recent column that men and women who do not marry and have children miss out on one of life's greatest joys, and that's marriage and parenthood. And I couldn't agree more. Here, I want us to close on this last question. What role does the church play, both Catholic and Protestant, play in revitalizing marriage and family, apart from just a message here and there on Mother's Day or Father's Day? Right. Do you have some specific ideas of what the church can do?
Let me close with two thoughts. One is that I think we can use the bully pulpit to shape some of those cultural scripts. That, you know, when you mentioned that column saying that, you know, people are missing out on some of life's greatest joys, they're missing out on it unintentionally, right? Because The cultural script they've been fed is that marriage, fatherhood, motherhood, children are, they ruin your life rather than they fulfill your life. I think someone like J.D. Vance is actually like very well situated. I love it when he's bringing his kids on these official state trips that he's engaged in. I think, you know, having little kids in the White House, perhaps one day, if that's going to be, you know, right now he's at the Naval Observancy, but, you know, if he's one day at the White House, I think that can be a positive cultural image. To your question specifically about the church, a friend of mine, J.P. DeGantz, runs a ministry called Communio. And it serves both Catholics and Protestant churches. And what he discovered is that it's something like less than 10% of churches, both Catholic and Protestant, have explicit marriage ministries, right? And so like, yes, maybe you get a sermon on Mother's Day or Father's Day. And like, yes, maybe every now and again, you're told that premarital sex is a sin. But other than that, there was like nothing going on. And so what his ministry Communio does is they will come in and partner with a local church and come up with kind of like a soup to nuts programmatic scheduling of what you can do. Things like having date nights where, you know, you'll the church itself will have babysitting for newlyweds with young kids so that the mom and the dad can get a night to foster their relationship. Marriage enrichment workshops, marriage enrichment retreats, all sorts of programming that he has come up with his ministry to just like give the best practices right to the church on here's what you can be doing on the ground, not just in your sermons, but in like the programming that you offer, the sorts of events that you offer on a Wednesday night, a Saturday night, et cetera, et cetera. I don't know if he's yet done this, but I think like the next area to go is to think through all these churches have youth groups, young adult groups. What can they be doing that would actually be effective at helping people get married, stay married? Frequently, the young adult groups, the youth ministry groups, they're hit or miss. And so I think that would be another area where you could bring some best practices to bear of here's how we can actually make this an alternative to the bar scene and the hookup scene without being hokey. And I think that'll be a very valuable, especially in a generation that has gotten more and more digitized, to have in-person, embodied, incarnate events where young people can get together, actually meet each other face-to-face, like, and kind of spark those relationships, that'll be a real service that the church can provide.
Yeah, very good. Well, Ryan Anderson, thank you so much for joining us here on the Commonwealth Matters, and we look forward to you joining us as well at our September 16th Conference on the Family and Cultural Renewal. Again, that's going to be at Southern Seminary, 5:30 in the evening, again, September the 16th. Ryan Anderson, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you. Pleasure to be with you.